Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Once again, well, I'm back home. Just completed a two-week health retreat, and I'll be sharing some insights from that a little later on in our program. I think you'll find it of interest. But we begin always with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the University of Colorado, and it's about ginger. Yeah. In fact, yesterday when I got back, I did some shopping. I had no food, and I saw a big bunch of ginger. Now, I have my own ginger here, and it flowers, and it can get 15 feet high, but it's the root that's important. And so if you can grow ginger, do so. It's easy to grow, very hardy, withstands cold and heat, but it's all the medicinal value is in the root. So you scrape the ginger off, right? Then there's several things you can do. First, you can marinate it, and that's good. And then you can slice it very thin. The key is the thinner you slice ginger, the better is going to be the outcome, and the more taste it you will see. And then I always like to use it lightly sauteed, not hot oil at all, and always use coconut oil, macadamia nut oil, or mustard seed oil, because they have high heat resistance. Even when I'm cooking brown rice, I always put 2 tablespoons of coconut oil in and I stir it into the rice. It coats the rice, so the rice is protected from being overcooked, and then I let it steep. And I don't boil rice for long, generally only about 10 minutes. Then I turn off the water, turn off the heat, and then put a cap on it and let it take an hour just to steep up. That way you get nice, fluffy, nutritional, rich rice. And that's true of all the grains. But anyhow, with ginger, I saute it separately and I slice garlic very thin, almost like a razor blade, almost like if you saw the movie Goodfellas, where the guy was in prison, he was slicing the garlic with a razor blade. Because the thinner you slice it, and in light heat, not high heat, that'll turn it acrid into a bitter. But if you gently cook it, saute it, and then you add things like coriander and cumin, and it really brings a whole flavor out. Then you combine the two, garlic and ginger, together in almost any dish. Well, in this case, they're saying when you use ginger, you're helping treat autoimmune disease. This is brand new research, so it shows a whole new role for ginger. Yes, we know ginger's good if you get seasick or airplane sickness, and yes, if you have upset stomach because inflammation in the stomach might be E. pylori, Helicobacter, or bacteria, or it might be just indigestion or bad food combining or having sugars, refined sugar in a meal that also has fat. That's a bad combination because the sugar requires no digestion, and the fat does. Fat can take hours to digest. So the sugar ferments, hence bloating, gas, distension, and bad bacteria. You know, this was published in JCI Insight, focused on ginger and the white blood cells called neutrophil, N-E-U-T-R-O-P-H-I-L, neutrophil, or phil, either way. Anyhow, so if you want to expand the anti-inflammatory capacity in your body, turn off inflammation. Well, how about people with arthritis? That's autoimmune. How about bursitis? How about fibromyalgia, lower back pain? All of it, ginger helps. So, just something, and it tastes good too. Now, the next study comes from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and it's about potassium in our foods. And it could lower your stroke risk, especially if you're a woman, let's say over the age of 40. Researchers have found that the older women whose diets include potassium-rich foods are at reduced risk of stroke and have a greater life expectancy than women consuming less potassium-rich foods. This was published in the American Heart Association's journal, Stroke, and it also suggests that postmenopausal women derive greater benefit from potassium-rich foods if they do not have high blood pressure. So this is important because there's a lot of foods that contain potassium, like a banana contains potassium. And when they found that women had increased the amount of potassium in the diet, it made a big difference. They were recommending the amount of potassium in their diets at least 4,700 milligrams of potassium daily. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But only 2.8% of women in this study met or exceeded that level. Wow. And there were 90,137 women, all postmenopausal, age 50 to 79, who were in the study. So it's a big study. And in fact, all the women were stroke-free when the study began. Their average dietary potassium intake was about 2,600 milligrams a day. And the researchers based the results on the study of potassium intake from foods rather than supplements. However, I believe that the average person is not going to be making that healthy choice to get that potassium in their diet. In fact, the people who were less likely to have a stroke in general than the women who ate the least, which was 1,900 milligrams of potassium a day. So what do you do? Well, there's two things you can do. One is start to look at cantaloupes, grapefruit, oranges, potatoes, especially yellow potatoes, red potatoes, purple potatoes, bananas, but the best of all, coconut water, organic coconut water. It's kind of a misnomer because almost all, look, there has been such a rush to get everything organic. I understand that. I brought the first organic teaching farm in New York State's history, the Furler Farm, 14 years. Thousands of people came up on the weekends, not per weekend, but on Sundays, we could get 400 or 500 people, and they'd come up and have lunch, take classes in farming, animal husbandry, meaning vegan animal husbandry, where you nurture the animal, you don't kill it, and just soil conservation. Even this morning, while I was away, I suggested to Mike, my caretaker, rip all the leaves off the trees that had a fungus, and especially lychee, because fruits are not going to grow on a tree that has fungus. And I said, just put on some long gloves up to the elbow and just strip them, all of them. He said, all of them? I said, every single leaf. And he did. I said, now immediately fertilize it around the tree. And he did. And I said, now spray it with a combination of cayenne and garlic diluted into a big container. And he's got this sprayer. He pumps it and sprays all over. So it's a non-toxic way to kill fungi. And especially in rainy season, and here it's rainy season. Last night, for example, there's a wonderful storm, rained for about 3 hours, and you hear the rain, and it's very calming. But it also is not, the over rain is not good for a lot of fruit trees because then fungus starts to grow, molds start to grow. This helps kill off the mold. In any case, this morning when I went out to run the dogs in the pasture, all brand new leaves. I mean, in 17 days, that's all I was gone. The tree is just loaded. And so then you have to fertilize almost every 2 weeks for a month. Much like with Calusa, you have to fertilize once a month. And then the Calusa, by the way, the Calusa is one of the most wonderful shrubs. It's decorative, it's beautiful looking, and you can get small pots. You don't need to get the big ones. And they're not expensive, about $17, 3 gallons. And you plant them and make sure they got good, rich soil to grow in. And then you don't touch them because they'll go through a 3 month period where nothing happens because they're dormant. But then when they do start to grow, they grow phenomenally thick and fast. And now, if you want something to give you privacy from people or noise, these can grow 4 foot thick, 20 foot high, and you can cut them twice a year when they're not in their growing phase. You don't cut them when they're growing because it'll shock them. Anyhow, but you have to fertilize them. See, the key to all really good agriculture is healthy soil. Soil with worms in them. You can put ladybugs around, little beetles that eat aphids and other predators. So you don't have to use toxic pesticides at all. But the trouble is people don't start with healthy soil. Just like a person eating junk food all day long. what's going to happen? Disease and death. Well, it's no different whether you... When was the last time you fertilized your palm tree out there? What do you mean? Well, you should fertilize all your trees 3 times a year. Fruit trees and non-fruit trees. I didn't know you had to fertilize it. How long has it been that way? 10 years. Would you notice all your branches are brown and you have no new green sprouts? The tree is dying of malnutrition. So for all of you who have a green thumb, fertilize, cut back. And by the way, if you have a fruit tree, it should not be taller than 9 foot, because you're not going to get the fruit is way up there. And also when the tree is growing, the energy is going in to the tree growing, not in growing the fruit. I took pictures. By the way, you can go up on GaryNall.com and you'll see just the last 6 months, at least I think there's 12 different types of fruit. And I mean hundreds and hundreds per tree. In fact, we had one tree with almost 1,000 different lychees on it. And then I cut it right after they're harvested. Then I fertilized the heck out of it, because it's like giving an infusion to a patient that needs an infusion. So anyhow, it's true for plants, it's true for humans. But you need potassium and coconut water at the beginning of the day. When I start my day, I have a 16-ounce glass of coconut water. That's around 900 to 1,000 milligrams of potassium. Now, potassium balances sodium. If you wonder why sometimes your feet swell, well, one of the reasons is excess sodium. And that's not good. That can raise your blood pressure. It can cause edema. And imbalances, too much sodium, can imbalance the electrical charge to the heart. Potassium is the great equalizer. In fact, people with cancer, you really need high potassium. And you need little sodium, not no sodium. You still need some sodium, about 800 milligrams. But coconut water is your best way of getting it. And then supplement, all right? So bananas, cantaloupe, grapefruit, oranges, potatoes are some of the good sources. Now another study, and this study comes from the National Institutes of Health, they find there's an association between elevated phthalate levels and an increased risk of postpartum depression. This was published in Environmental Influences on Health Outcomes. And so the more prenatal phthalates or plasticizers and artificial chemicals that the mother's exposed to, you're going to see an increased risk of postpartum depression. So just saying, get rid of all the chemicals, like plastic containers, don't microwave your food. And finally, from Harvard Business School, everyday evidence may bring us unexpected joy in the future. What do I mean? According to the study, doing the housework or chatting with a work colleague over lunch are unlikely to be events you go out of your way to capture as a memory. But a new study suggests that everyday experiences that we overlook may bring us pleasure in the future. And just think if you were to learn a new word every day, but a word you could use to increase your vocabulary. Think if you started to learn a word or a sentence in a foreign language, all right? French, German, Japanese, Spanish. So anything that we do on a daily basis that forces us to grow and be focused enhances our well-being as we age, because then we've got this treasure chest of experiences and knowledge. Just like think of the times when you were in your 20s or 30s and you knew that you were going to have to settle down, and so you just decide to have your bucket list early in life, not at the end of life, so you could really experience it. And all over the world, people travel. Going to a country you've never been, don't know much about the culture, as much as you could learn on the internet, far more rich experience to learn in person. And so do things that enhance the quality of your life by increasing all of your lifetime experiences. And that's important. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I try to select clips to show you that present original, qualified information. It's accurate. From people who themselves have outstanding backgrounds, meaning they've lived a life in their careers, whatever it is, with a sense of dignity and honesty. and we can trust them. Here's one. You're going to hear now an extended interview or commentary from a man who's testifying before a state, I think it's South Carolina. He's a professor, he's a PhD, Philip Buchholz, Buchholz. But what he is saying, you have not heard before. No one's heard before. Brand new. I'm sharing it with you today. No newspaper will publish this. They can't. Then nobody in the establishment can dare let this information out. And yet this is one of their people. He's pro-vaccine. He's pro-COVID protocols. But he's also an independent scientist with his whole team at the university, and they're highly respected. And he's saying, he's a cancer genomics expert. He's one of the best minds in the country. And he's saying the FDA made a huge error in not doing detailed health studies, because what he has found in the vaccines, all of the vaccines, billions, could be 200 billion human DNA that shouldn't be in there. Shouldn't be any in there. Okay, so you say, okay, so we've got some DNA in there. What's the big deal? Because this is not normal science. They're using something in here based upon how they genetically engineered it. Could mean that transfers transcription into your cell. Weren't we told that the vaccine will only last hours to days? Yes, it was all fraudulent. No, that was true. Weren't we told it was safe and effective? Also lies. They knew and hid the truth. But this means that we could end up with cancers if you got the vaccine. It means up. He's saying, you'll hear him say it. And look, normally I wouldn't play a clip like this because the first part of it, he's just establishing his credentials. I guess because he fears he's going to be attacked. But he's one of the smartest guys in the world in what he does, in genes, gene therapy. And so he gives a little longer time. But then he goes into science and he shows charts. Mind you, he's one of the people that everyone in the government agencies go to in science when they need to know something about genetics. He's at the top of the top, and he's all orthodox. But you'll hear his contempt, if you listen carefully to what he says, about the bad science involved, the rush science that shouldn't have happened. And what he's telling us is that those DNA can now go into our cells and be there for the rest of our life. And he says we could get cancer and autoimmune diseases. Do you remember when I told you one of the fears I had was they're giving vaccines that have never been experimented on people with autoimmune conditions? They excluded people with, no one was allowed in their study if you had autoimmune condition, if you were pregnant, if you were a child, a baby, senior citizen, if you had cancer, dementia, heart disease. All those people were excluded. But then the vaccine comes out and all those people with no exceptions are mandated to take the vaccine. Well, hold on a second. We have 130 million people known to have autoimmune conditions. That means their immune system is highly reactive in attacking their own cells. So you're going to put a vaccine together that's going to cause the cells to create spike proteins, which are known to be toxic, and they don't last hours or days, and they're not located just in the deltoid muscle. They're in every cell of your body, and that's going to cause a hyper autoimmune response to where your organs fail and people die? Yes. And this guy says autoimmune conditions. So I predicted it. I told you. I shared this with you. I went into the science of it. I wrote an article on it. So for those of you who didn't get the vaccine, boy, are you on the right side of the health issue. So we could be looking at tens of millions of Americans having severe adverse results, including autoimmune conditions, organ breakdown, cancers, and death. Better reaffirm your knowledge before you get these boosters that they're promoting now, including to pregnant women. Before you do that, why don't you go over and read any of the good science that they're finding about what actually happened when they got the government to give them the documents of Pfizer that wanted to hide it for 75 years, adverse effects on pregnant women, 5,000% increase of the women in miscarriages and stillbirths and defects, and now sterility, who took the vaccine, and they're advocating now, actively advocating pregnant women should get the vaccine because it'll help enhance the immune system of their babies. They had no studies. There were no studies. These people are criminal. And one day, we will have a new Nuremberg trial. They'll be held accountable. Now to the clip.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Philip Buchholz. I have a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology. I'm a cancer gene jock. Basically, I do cancer genomics research at the University of South Carolina. And what that means is that I'm kind of an expert on all the ways that the human genome can get fussed with during your lifetime and which of those things cause cancer and which ones don't. Okay. So technically, that means that I'm very, very skilled in the art of DNA sequencing. Okay, I can figure out the sequence of things that I didn't know what I was looking for. And I'm also pretty good, when I say I mean the people in my laboratory, you're not going to hear their names, but there's a group of people that do this excellent work. We're really good at detecting foreign pieces of DNA in places where they're not supposed to be, even if they're real low levels. And we use those skills during the pandemic. We invented the COVID test that many of you did, a spit test. Okay, that came out of my lab because we were really good at that kind of stuff. And so I've earned a fair amount of respect in the state of South Carolina and in this body because we did a ton of COVID testing in the middle of the night when people were afraid, and we told them, no, you don't have COVID in your home, or yes, you do. So my qualifications to comment on this are both technical and kind of relational in the state of South Carolina. I'll cut to a very narrow theme here, but it does touch on lots of these regulatory issues, and I'll leave it to you to expand on those if you want to. I'll try to stay in this narrow lane of some problems in the Pfizer vaccine as a case study for places in which regulatory oversight could be improved. All right, so first of all, let me say that my interpretation of the literature is that the Pfizer vaccine did a pretty good job of keeping people from dying, but it did a terrible job of stopping the pandemic. The early publications showed that it stopped infection, but that only lasted for like a month.
Dr. Buchholz, could you pull the mic a little closer to you? Staff's telling me they're having trouble getting you on the recording.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
In my professional evaluation of the literature, the Pfizer vaccine did a pretty good job of keeping people out of the cemetery, but it sucked at stopping the pandemic. And it was the best of sucky options that we had. And I still believe that it was deployed mostly in good faith, but there were a lot of shortcuts taken because the house was on fire, and we could do a better job next time from the lessons that we're going to learn here. That's my own personal view of this, but I'm also, my philosophical bent here is, I'm sure many of you have heard of Occam's razor, right? Choose the simplest of explanations. Well, there's another one called Hanlon's razor, which is never attribute malice to that which can be better explained by incompetence. And so I'm trying to be gracious here in circumstances. There could be malice underneath, but I'm trying to see just incompetence to be gracious. So the Pfizer vaccine is contaminated with plasmid DNA. It's not just mRNA. It's got bits of DNA in it. This DNA is the DNA vector that was used as the template for the in vitro transcription reaction when they made the mRNA. I know this is true because I sequenced it in my own lab. The vials of Pfizer vaccine that were given out here in Columbia, one of my colleagues was in charge of that vaccination program in the College of Pharmacy, and for reasons that I still don't understand, he kept every single vial. So he had a whole freezer full of the empty vials. Well, the empty vials have a little tiny bit in the bottom of them. He gave them all to me, and I looked at them. We had two batches that were given out here in Columbia, and I checked these two batches, and I checked them by sequencing. And I sequenced all the DNA that was in the vaccine, and I can see what's in there. And it's surprising that there's any DNA in there, and you can kind of work out what it is and how it got there, and I'm kind of alarmed about the possible consequences of this, both in terms of human health and biology, but you should be alarmed about the regulatory process that allowed it to get there. So this DNA, in my view, it could be causing some of the rare but serious side effects like death from cardiac arrest. So there's a lot of cases now of people having suspicious death after vaccine. It's hard to prove what caused it. It's just, you know, temporally associated. And this DNA is a plausible mechanism. Okay. This DNA can and likely will integrate into the genomic DNA of cells that got transfected with the vaccine mix. This is just the way it works. We do this in the lab all the time. We take pieces of DNA, we mix them up with a lipid complex like the Pfizer vaccine is in. We pour it onto cells, and a lot of it gets into the cells, and a lot of it gets into the DNA of those cells, and it becomes a permanent fixture of the cell. It's not just a temporary thing. It is in that cell and all of its progeny from now on forevermore. Amen. So that's why I'm kind of alarmed about this DNA being in the vaccine. It's different from RNA because it can be permanent. This is a real hazard for genome modification of long-lived somatic cells like stem cells. And it could cause, theoretically, this is all a theoretical concern, but it's pretty reasonable based on solid molecular biology, that it could cause a sustained autoimmune attack toward that tissue. It's also a very real theoretical risk of future cancer in some people. Depending on where in the genome this foreign piece of DNA lands, it can interrupt a tumor suppressor or activate an oncogene. I think it'll be rare, but I think the risk is not zero, and it may be high enough that we are to figure out if this is happening or not. And again, the autoimmunity thing is not my wheelhouse. I'm not an immunologist, but the cancer risk is. That's my bag. I know this is a thing, and it is a possibility. Okay, a little nerdy science here. The central dogma of molecular biology is that DNA gets transcribed into RNA, okay? And then RNA gets translated into protein. This is just how life runs. Why does this matter? Well, DNA, for the purposes of this discussion, DNA is a long-lived information storage device. Okay, what you were born with, you're going to die with and pass on to your kids. DNA lasts for hundreds of thousands of years, and it can last for generations if you pass it on to your kids. Right? So alterations to the DNA, they stick around. RNA, by its nature, is temporary. It doesn't last, and that feature of RNA was part of the sales pitch for the vaccine. The pseudouridine was supposed to make the RNA last a little bit longer, but still, it's a transient phenomenon. We're talking hours to days, okay? And then proteins. Once proteins are made, they also don't last forever. They last for hours to days. But something that makes its way into DNA has the potential to last for a very long time, maybe a lifetime. So this is a picture of the sequencing read that the sequencing run that I did in the lab from a couple of batches of the Pfizer vaccine. And all those little bitty lines here are the little tiny pieces of DNA that are in the vaccine. They don't belong there. They are not part of the sales pitch or the marketing campaign. And they're there. There's a lot of them. This little graph here in the middle is the size distribution that peaks around 100 base pairs, 120 base pairs. So the DNA pieces that are in the vaccine are short little pieces, 100, 120. There's some that are about 500 base pairs, a few that are even 5,000, but most of them are around 100 base pairs. Why is this important? Because the probability of a DNA piece of DNA integrating into the human genome is unrelated to its size. So your genome risk is just a function of how many particles there are. So it's like, you know, if you shoot a shotgun at a washboard, if you shoot a slug, you have some probability of hitting it. And if you shoot buckshot, you have a bigger probability of hitting it with some shot, right? This, all these little pieces of DNA that are in the vaccine are analogous to buckshot. You have many, many thousands of opportunities to modify a cell of a vaccinated person. The pieces are very small because during the process, they chopped them up to try to make them go away, but they actually increased the hazard of genome modification in the process. That's how this got here. In my view, somebody should go about sequencing DNA samples from stem cells of people who are vaccinated and find out if this theoretical risk has happened or not. I think this is a real serious oversight, regulatory oversight, that happened at the federal level, and somebody should force this to happen somewhere.
Dr. Buchholz, yes. If you allow, are you capable of doing that?
Yeah, we do that kind of thing. But in order for it to be trustworthy by the public, this has to be done by lots of people.
Okay. Right? I'll talk to you more about that later.
Yeah, this is our deal. This is why I know this should have been done at the federal level. Okay. So we took all these pieces of DNA and we used them to glue together what the source DNA must have been. This is kind of, again, this is our what we do in the lab all the time. And all these little red and green lines here, these are all independent little pieces of DNA. This must have had 100,000 pieces of DNA in this sequencing run. And you can put them all back together and see what they came from is this circle over here. It's a plasmid that you can go shopping online to buy from Agilent. And it's clear that Pfizer took this plasmid and then they cloned Spike into it. And they used it in a process called in vitro transcription translation, in vitro transcription, where you feed an RNA polymerase this plasmid and it makes a whole bunch of mRNA copies for you. Okay, and then you take this mRNA, you mix it with the lipid nanoparticle transfection reagent, and now you've got your mRNA vaccine, but they failed to get the DNA out before they did this. So these little pieces, they did make some effort to chop it up, so all these little pieces of the plasmid got packaged in with the RNA. That's clear as day what happened just from the forensics of looking at the DNA sequencing. Okay, a little bit of a regulatory note here. The way you do RNA transcription, in vitro transcription reactions, you have to give it a DNA template, okay? And you can give it a DNA template that is just a synthetic piece of DNA that is only the instructions to make the RNA, and that's what was done for getting the emergency use authorization and the clinical trial. It's called Process 1 if you look up that kind of stuff. They made a PCR product of just the bits that they wanted, and then they did the in vitro transcription, made a bunch of RNA of that. There was no plasmid DNA to contaminate the stuff that was used for the trial. But that making that PCR product doesn't scale the way that was necessary to vaccinate the whole world. So a cheaper way to scale up the production of this template is to clone that PCR product into this plasmid vector, put the plasmid vector into bacteria, and then you can grow up big vats of the bacteria. They make a lot of the plasmid DNA for you. Then you use that plasmid DNA as the template to drive this transcription reaction to make your RNA. And that's where how the contamination ended up in the production batches, even though it was not in the stuff that was used for the authorization trials. So I know it's a little bit of nerdy science, but it has regulatory implications for you guys. we can measure the quantity of this stuff pretty easy in the lab. This is we're good at doing this kind of stuff. This is the same. We made a little PC. A colleague of mine at MIT made, you know, from who used to work for the Broad Institute at MIT, he made a little PCR test and we cloned it here. This is similar to the PCR test that you all took for the spit test. Okay, same idea and same expertise behind it. And we can quantify exactly how much of this stuff is in a vaccine or any other tissue. And, you know, I estimate that there were about 2 billion copies of the one piece that we're looking for in every dose. And if you look back at that map I showed you where it's all these little, the little piece that we're looking for is just that little bit right there, okay? But if you see 2 billion copies of this, there's about 200 billion of everything else. So what this means is that there's probably about 200 billion pieces of this plasmid DNA in each dose of the vaccine, and it's encapsulated in this lipid nanoparticle, so it's ready to be delivered inside the cell. Okay? This is a bad idea. My conclusions from this, we should check a bunch of people. My conclusions from this, or I should learn how to run PowerPoint. We should check a bunch of vaccinated people getting tissue samples, especially if we focus on harmed people, but that's not necessary. We could also just focus on regular unharmed people and see if this plasmid DNA is integrating into the genomes of any of their stem cells. It leaves a calling card that is there. One of the reasons why I'm focusing on this is because it's kind of different from a lot of the other imagined harms where you can't really prove it. You can be suspicious because of the timing, but you can't really prove it. This one, you can prove it because it leaves a calling card. Okay. You find it in the stem cells of harmed people. It's equivalent to finding a certain type of lead in someone who is now dead. It's pretty reasonable to assume that that's what caused it. The royal we, meaning you guys, should insist that the FDA force Pfizer to get the DNA out of the booster and all future versions of this vaccine. I'm a real fan of this platform, okay? I think it has the potential to treat cancers. I really believe that this platform is revolutionary, and in your lifetime, there will be mRNA vaccines against antigens in your unique cancer, okay? But they got to get this problem fixed, okay? And I right now, I think the financial incentives are too great to just keep on rolling with it, and it's going to take some encouragement to get it out. The regulation that allowed this DNA to be there in the first place, I don't think that the amounts there actually exceed the regulation limits. In some batches, it may. In the two batches that I looked at, one of them, it was just under the limit, and one, it was just over the limit. My colleague in Boston has looked at a fair number of other batches, and there's a handful that are super high, and there's a handful that are super low. But the fact that there is a regulatory threshold for amount of DNA allowed in a vaccine is a throwback to an era when we were talking about vaccines that were like a recombinant protein that you, or a dead virus, you know, attenuated virus produced in CHO cells or something like that. And the DNA that might be in it is naked DNA. And you might have a little bit in the vaccine. That's not a problem because naked DNA gets chewed up immediately upon vaccination and there's no real mechanism for it to get inside the cells. They inappropriately applied that regulatory limit to this new kind of vaccine where everything is encapsulated in this lipid nanoparticle. It's basically packaged in a synthetic virus able to dump its contents into a cell. So I'm thinking Hanlon's razor here. Okay. I don't think there was anything nefarious here. I think it was just kind of a dumb oversight. And it's going to take, because the financial incentives are so great to just, you know, sweep it under the rug, and the career incentives of people that approve this are going to be, oh, there's nothing wrong here. You know, it's going to take some encouragement to make people prove that it's okay. But I really believe this was an inappropriate application of an old school regulation to a new kind of vaccine. And who knows, maybe we'll check a bunch of people and we'll find out for sure that this is indeed not a problem. And that will do the public good if we prove that.
Mind you, you're not going to see this anywhere because they can't let people know this or nobody would take the vaccines. And then there'd be lawsuits against those who've gotten the vaccines for the unintended consequences. If you have a thought on this, if I have time at the end of the program, I'll be happy to take your calls. Our talk back number is 888-874-4888. But I want to play you the clip of Sean Penn, who is an influencer, and he's an outstanding actor. I've enjoyed all of his films. But then when he took that gold, you know, statue to Zelensky, and now he's promoting the vaccines, but it's not how he's promoting them. It's what he's saying to those who have not yet been vaccinated or refuse to be vaccinated. Let's watch the clip.
If you like Sean Penn's rhetoric when it comes to the Ukraine war, let us not forget his rhetoric at one point when it came to the COVID-19.
Well, let me guess, did they coincide as the ultimate?
Kind of, you know, in a way, but Kurt, wear your seatbelts.
What does that mean? Can't go around pointing a gun in somebody's face, which is what it is when people are unvaccinated.
I have personally very little tolerance with those who don't exercise that common sense courtesy. They have to look at their lifestyle.
Oh my God, what is that? Oh my God, what is that?
I would like to see if we can just come up with an American mask to wear for the next 6 to 12 months.
At this point, it seems criminal to me, actually. Someone chooses not to be vaccinated, that they should choose to stay home, not go to work, not have a job.
Sean Penn is refusing to return to work on Starz' Gaslit. The actor is demanding all cast and crew of the Watergate series to receive the COVID-19 vaccine before returning to work on set.
If you believe that everyone should get vaccinated, I believe it should be mandatory, like turning your headlights on in a car at night. So I'll go back to Gaslit when I can be assured that the 100% of the crew has gotten vaccinated. I would request that only vaccinated audiences have an opportunity to see this. Eventually it will stream. And that's a better time for the unvaccinated to see it.
Immediately now.
You know, I hope that audiences are drawn to it. Specifically, I hope that vaccinated audiences are drawn to it.
I'm telling you right now, I've seen see what it. I needed to see.
Who's that?
Justin Bieber, right?
But why?
Because I think he was injured and was kind of like I don't know why they put that in there in this particular video, but I think it was something to do with the fact that he had changed his whole stance on it after.
Yeah, well, he had John Fetterman face. Yeah.
And by the way, I said it wrong. I said, put your seatbelts on. Because he said, because Sean Penn made the thing as like, you have to do it. It's like putting your car lights on in the night. I thought at one point he said, like, putting your seatbelts on before you drive a car. I think he said that in another interview.
He's been saying stuff like that
all the time. I think it's about as much common sense as putting your seatbelts on.
Has he gotten his boosters since his thing?
I have no clue.
There's new boosters out, and I think it's, well, okay.
Needs to get it caught up to date if he wants a new one.
I don't agree with Sean Penn on everything, but I'm sure he's up to date on his boosters for the upcoming triple-demic. I'm sure he saw the call of the Empire State Building lit up Pfizer blue.
Yep.
I would like to see some
and
yellow.
And Kurt, if you're not up to date, you can't go to work with him either, because that's how
and
much power that guy's got.
You will not have the pleasure of working with the Sean Penn.
He certainly has a freedom to make his opinion known, but there should be someone responding to that to show you that everything he just said was scientifically inaccurate. We're going to take a break and come back because we have a lot to share with you. In fact, when we come back, I'm going to share some of the testimonies, unrehearsed, non-coached. They're just sitting around on Friday, this past Friday, right after lunch, and they're just telling about their experiences. Now, mind you, you go to a resort, you go to a club, PubMed, you go, you know, to a yoga camp. You're going to have a good time. You're going to enjoy yourself. You're going to relax. Dance and, you know, eat, drink, not yoga camps. But this is not what happened to these people. When you come to one of these retreats, a whole lot of things you didn't expect can happen. But I had more than 20 people had similar comments. Let's listen to those three when we come back. We're coming right into the clips when we come back.
Hi, my name is Leah, and I'm ending my 5-week retreat at Gary Knowles. And I came here with a lot of pain in my heart and some very unexplained health issues and a lot of emotional discomfort within myself. And a lot of unknowns. And I'm leaving here with a lot of new information. And I'm leaving here with a heart that feels like it's prepared to go back to where I'm from and handle the things I need to handle. And how I'm really going to think about what I want for my life and in a whole different way, and make some changes as far as where I live and some relationship changes that are toxic, and let myself live the life I want to live. And I think I've never really said to myself that I can be happy, and it's time for me to be happy. And what happy means is a self growth, and I'm getting there piece by piece, one step at a time, and I'm leaving with a lot of exercises and work that I can do at home to continue the work that I've learned here. And I'm very appreciative to Gary Knoll and the people that have been his part of the support team here. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Cheryl. I'm here at Gary Knoll's retreat. This is my second time here. The reason I'm here is because the first time, it was amazing, and I know that Gary can help with my problems. He helped me the first time. He's doing it again. I've been here for 5 days, and I can tell you that the problems that I had are gone away. I feel like a 25-year-old in my body, and I am actually 75 years old. So what he has done here is amazing, and the staff is just, I'm blown away by their service and their professionalism, and they're just also loving and kind. And all the retreaters that came, we all have the same mindset, and we all want to get better, and we know where to go to get it because Gary has the tools. So I'm leaving here with the information, the knowledge, the education to carry on. And my pain that I had in my knees, I could hardly walk when I came here. He suggested that I ride a bike so that I can strengthen my legs. And it worked in 5 days. I feel, it's amazing. I mean, I had to use the wheelchair coming here in the airport. I don't have to do that going home. So I'm very grateful for what he did. I had heart palpitations coming here. I didn't have one the first day I did, but after that, I don't have them. So I will be continuing to come as long as Gary will invite me and as long as he has this. And I'm just amazed at what he can do. And I'm glad that I've discovered him. And so that's my story, and I'm sure I'll have more to tell you in the future. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Linda. I have just spent a wonderful 2 weeks at the retreat with Gary Knoll. I came here with a cancer diagnosis, and it was not a good one. Basically, my mind had a lot to do with that, and what I have come to realize is that I can speak things into existence, that I have power. I have been given great tools while I have been here with a gourmet vegan diet, exercise, meditation, yoga. All of these things are here to help me on my journey. The positive mindset to me that I have learned from Gary has probably been what I would consider priceless, because we take a lot of things for granted, and a lot of times we don't really see who we are. We don't see ourselves. But with the quiet solitude that I have experienced, I have been able to truly reflect, and things, the clarity has just been amazing on what I see and who I am and what I need to do. I have so many tools leaving here, and I'm just so grateful for this opportunity. I know that I'm going on the right path, and I will continue. When I came, I was told that there was nothing else that they could do, and not sure how much time I would have. But since being here, I know that I'm going to live. I know I'm going to live a long and healthy life. Gary has helped so much in my journey. And I know when I leave, I'm going to continue to do what I need to do so that I will live. And I just appreciate everything that I have learned and gained from this retreat. This has been truly invaluable. Once again, this is Linda, and I just say, if at all possible, try to make your way to the retreat. It will change your life, literally.
Hi, my name is Amal. I just finished a week retreat with Gary Knoll. I actually came here with the severe osteoporosis. I have intense back pain, and I had compression fractures that have healed, but I've had them over the years. It was due to the severe osteoporosis. I basically got a call from my doctor. I got my DEXA scan, and she called me that same day, urging me to go to see an endocrinologist to get some bone injection. Well, the next thing I did, of course, I reached out to Luann, and I came to the retreat. The place is incredible. The staff is amazing. The environment, the animals around, it's all part of the process of helping people heal. Like everywhere you look, you feel like there's just healing in the air, whether it's the solitude or the courses that, or the exercises or anything else. You can choose what you would like to do depending, because everyone comes here at a different level, at a different stage in their life. For me specifically, I've had my dark night of the soul over the decades, and I got started on my spiritual journey. So that part I was familiar with. The other parts that I neglected, unfortunately, were my physical being and my mental being and how my emotions were impacting my body. So I'm learning the tools that I need to go back and implement in terms of giving more love to myself. And then once I learn how to do that, that will pour out to share with the rest of the people around me and in the world. And I definitely, if you are able to come, I cannot imagine a better place to come for healing and everything that comes with the healing. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Judy. I've been here a week with Gary, and I have obesity, and I found that I never really took time for myself to exercise. I've learned here that my own personal care is sacred. And I'm leaving knowing that I can restructure my day to include time for me and my goals to rid myself of all my excess weight. I know I've had a second chance because this is the second time I've been here. The healing that Gary gave me personally was so transformative. I have to express, I felt physically lighter, a surge of energy. I feel so much more alert and softer and available for enjoying the world. This is a medicine I've never experienced before. And we all are sharing it, being here as a group, but especially from Gary. Gary shares from his heart and all his life experiences, and it's an honor to know him as a friend and to be here with all the wonderful people. Thank you.
That's our program for today. Again, every day I'm going to share new information, and starting tomorrow, our theme for this week, our theme last week was woke and the cancel culture. This week is about what happened to our educational system from middle school and grade school to college, graduate school? Something is amiss. We're going to speak with teachers. I reviewed dozens and dozens of videos of teachers, long-term teachers at every level of education, and then a whole group coming together who quit. Why? What was wrong that they quit? They'll tell you. See if you can understand now why we have a lot of illiterate children coming out of schools of all levels. That's tomorrow. Thank you all for watching. Please share this with other people, and have a nice day.